Thank you very much, and good morning. Nice to see familiar faces and new faces, and thanks for choosing us over those Christmas markets and the sunshine. But they'll still be on afterwards, so it's really nice to see all of you here today, and I'm excited to hear more about this play. Well, our first director is Estelle Shook, artistic and managing director of Caravan Farm Theatre in Armstrong, B.C. Estelle has produced, developed, and directed more than 40 outdoor productions for that company. Off-the-farm career highlights include associate director of the Canadian Opera Company production of Louis Riel with Peter Hinton, and director of the Canadian stage premiere of Jordan Tannehill's Sunday in Sodom, which garnered 6 DORA nominations and won the DORA Award for Outstanding Production. Also, for Canadian stage, she's directed Julius Caesar and The Winter's Tale, and toured Stan Douglas's Helen Lawrence to Brooklyn and Antwerp, and she's thrilled to be joining the Belfry team with Every Brilliant Thing. Please welcome Estelle Shook.
Let's get comfortable here.
Yes, exactly.
Hello, everyone. Thanks, Gregor.
I wonder if you can tell us a bit about Caravan Farm Theatre. You're the artistic director. It sounds like an extremely unique theatre. Can you tell us a bit more about the company and why people refer to it as a magical place?
Well, Caravan Farm Theatre is located in the interior, and as you can imagine from the title, it's very rural, and we own and operate our own venue, so very much like the Belfry. That generates a very strong sense of home, a strong sense of place, and allows us to cultivate really strong relationships with the local community. And because it's rural, it offers something really unique to artists, professional artists across the country, who more often than not are working in urban environments and living in urban environments. So precisely what makes it magical is its rural location, the fact that we are outdoors, that the audience is outdoors, and that the artists are working together in the space, sharing a space, living on the land, essentially, while they rehearse and produce and build the work. And again, very much like the Belfry, a strong fellowship, a culture of fellowship is created when you are working in a very special place with unique features, like this beautiful building here.
I was telling you before the show, I drive through Armstrong every summer on my way to the Kootenays, and I always think I should stop. Here's another reason. And so is the summer a good time? What would you say to people who might want to make a visit to take in a show?
Well, I'd say summer is fantastic. Of course, the Okanagan has so much to offer. Wine, food, so many outdoor activities, not least of which is Caravan Farm Theatre. We do a big spectacular summer show incorporating large-scale elements. We have, you know, horses and trucks and all sorts of things and amazing artists from across the country. Live music, it's a real experience. And the winter show is something that's not to be discounted. If you were to make a trek over the Coquihalla or fly into Kelowna for the winter, you'd experience, if you book early enough, the world's only winter sleigh ride theater. So we have 10 teams of heavy horses who pull sleighs throughout the 80 acres. This year we're doing a wild redux of the Nutcracker with circus elements. And the horses take you through scene locations, and actors are on their own stage management sleigh. And it's really, like, there's nothing like it in the world. It's remarkable.
All right. I'm coming to Armstrong. What about coming to Victoria for Every Brilliant Thing? It's your debut at the Belfry Theatre, and what's it been like for you directing in this different environment, or this environment?
Well, it's been indoors for one, which is fantastic. But no, the Belfry has a reputation across Canada for being a really special, really excellent place to work, and I've heard and I've known of this reputation for some time, and exceeded my expectations. The company here, the production team, the administrative team, everyone in this building is doing it all for the right reasons, is really connected to the community, and places such a high value on the art. And so I've felt, as an artist here, as a guest artist, incredibly supported, as have Dawn, as have Brian and Lance and the gang in this show. Yeah, and the building is beautiful, special, well cared for. The art, the attention to detail is remarkable. Just the calm organization of the place and the sense that the community is really has an ownership of the beautiful lobby and the neighborhood. It feels warm and inviting and it's an optimum place to create work.
So you're creating every brilliant thing, and I wonder what can you tell us about this play? I know you don't want to give away too much, but it seems to really have moved a number of theater goers. What can you tell us about this play?
Yes. This piece is really special. It's unique. It's very innovative in the sense that the audience is our participants. You are co-creating this piece of theater in the room with the performer, and you are building essentially, building the list. And so the idea behind this play is that a list of nice things can combat hardwired depression, which is a beautiful idea. And what this play does is put that into practice. So on the one hand, it's a really classical piece of narrative theater, very structured in a beautiful five-act structure. It's a well-made play. So anybody, a theater aficionado who loves text, who loves construction, who loves a kind of dramaturgical, the rigors of the dramaturgical, will love this piece. But beyond that, what makes it so profound is that it's a virtuosic feat of storytelling and direct engagement with the audience. So it's no coincidence, it's no wonder that the person who originated this role was a comedian, Johnny Donahoe. And so he, in a way, co-authored this piece with Duncan MacMillan. It would not be the piece without what Johnny Donahoe gave to it in performance throughout, I don't know how many years of a run that toured the globe. And so what this piece requires is, one, an incredible comedian, and a comedian, of course, who is all about engagement and a shared humanity with the audience, but also a really powerful dramatic actor. In one person, that's really hard. Mm-hmm. So what makes it so special is that it's an encounter with a really remarkable human being, a performer, an artist, who is recounting a really beautifully constructed, very meaningful story under supported by incredibly meaningful ideas. Ideas like, can we focus on what is the nature of hope? What do we hold on to get us through the rough times? And can a list of nice things combat hardwired depression? And I think, as Ivan mentioned, yes, it can. Lots of other things go into it too, but at the heart of this piece is tremendous life-affirming hope.
What about the humor? I wonder how that helps talk about depression, without trivializing it, which I know you don't want to do, and obviously the playwrights didn't want to do. What can you tell us about the mix of humor and such a serious and important topic?
Sure. Well, some wise person has said that comedy is tragedy plus time, and it's true. It's true. Everything in this piece is real, and it's been interesting. Over the four-week rehearsal process, there were some very emotional days in the rehearsal hall with Dawn. And Dawn's an incredible actor. A feature of an incredible actor is their sensitivity, their availability to image, to emotion, to influence that works on them. And then they feel it, they express it. And so there were many teary hours every weekend where she'd just say, oh, it's so hard. She would despair because it's hard. Now I say all that, but that's not what the play is. Yes, like any great play, like any great tragedy, there is a depth and there's weight and magnitude to the material. But what, in fact, this play is, it's about how one overcomes or triumphs that by trading in humor, by making all of those things humorous. There's a lot of gallows humor, which is fantastic. Like, who among us doesn't enjoy some good gallows humor? So really, ultimately, I say there were some tears, but I would say 90% of the time, we laughed our faces off because it's so funny, because Dawn's so funny, because that's what the play is about. It's about laughing together.
I wonder, though, as a director, and I've wondered this about other plays, if it is especially emotional or difficult, and you see your actors really taking that on, I mean, do you ever worry for them or despair or just want to try to keep them on an even keel? You know, I wonder if you're worried about their
mental health?
Yeah, about their mental health as you're going along, yeah.
Sure. No, absolutely. I think that's something we do deal with in the theater because, as you said before, this is one play among most plays that we work with as theater artists that deal with heavy things. Mm-hmm. The plays are all about crises and how we deal with them. And so it's not unique in its delving into material. Any one of the Shakespearean tragedies, you know, we're in that zone. So, yes, it's important to make sure that mental health is at the forefront of our working practice and best processes as they evolve. One of the things that we did, well, first of all, you acknowledge that it's hard work, as it always, and you created containers. And so in the mornings, we would always put on a different jazz record. So because there's jazz is throughout this piece. It's a gorgeous part of what makes this play so wonderful. And jazz is such a medicine. Mm. Like, it really works on your brain waves in powerful ways. So we'd fill the room with music all the time. We have great people in the room who know how to take care of themselves because they're professionals. And we kept our eye on the prize, which is to say the most important about this piece is that it's an encounter between the performer, the storyteller, and the audience. And it's actually about finding the joy and the humor in the material. That's what's always happening. There are moments when there's a moment of, say, reflection and relived moment in any one of the emotional moments, but they're just sparked, and then we're back into the humor and back into the comedy of the moment, because that's the primary mode.
So what do you hope audiences take away from this play? I'm sure you don't want to be too prescriptive, but what's your hope as a director when you stage this?
Well, two things. I think what I share with what I imagine the playwright's hope is that it's the play is an offering to audience and people everywhere that depression can be overcome. You're not weird. You're not strange. You can get through this, and this is how. This is one way. This is how I got through it, with a lot of joy and a lot of humor and a lot of compassion. So there's that. And then on a more meta level, as a theater maker, what I would love the audience to take away from this piece is that an affirmation that as audience members, we are co-creators. We co-imagine that we are engaged in theater, and we participate as storytellers all the time by going to theater and by what you're all doing here today, by being interested in the larger ideas at work in the piece and how what you bring when you come to see the piece, that will exert a powerful influence in the room. You being actively engaged with the ideas in the piece. And I think that's great for theater in general and great for civil society.
Estelle, thank you for joining us. It's great to have you with us here.
Thanks, Gregor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Estelle Shook is the director of Every Brilliant Thing on stage at the Belfry. Our next guest is Jane Taylor. Jane is a psychotherapist, child specialist, divorce coach, and facilitator. She's worked with civilian and military individuals and families for 22 years, assisting them with challenges ranging from separation and divorce, communication, intimacy, parenting, anger management, and domestic violence, to coping with and managing symptoms of post-traumatic stress. Jane has researched, designed, and facilitated couples workshops addressing anger management and violence prevention, parenting, intimacy, depression, grief, and loss. And she's here to talk to us about some of the themes behind the play and in the community as well. Please welcome Jane Taylor, who's the Executive Director of the Family Services of Greater Victoria. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Can you tell us about your journey as a psychotherapist and child specialist and also what you do with the Family Services of Greater Victoria?
Absolutely. I've been a psychotherapist for almost 24 years now, and primarily working with parents who are higher conflict, who are going through separation and divorce, and really working as a child advocate and an advocate for the family as a whole, so that we can help them navigate the challenges of separation, divorce, and work towards the best outcome for everyone in the family. And then in terms of my journey, I studied at Adler University in Chicago. I'm from Canada, but I went to the States and did some work there, and then realized that where my passion really lay was in listening to families and finding out what were the complexities. Every family is unique, but they share similarities and patterns. And how could I best take the skills that I had and the interest I had and actually create a professional life from that? So then I went from 24 years in private practice to becoming Executive Director of Family Services of Greater Victoria. And I've been in that role now for about a year and a half.
And what about Family Services of Greater Victoria? Can you give us a brief glimpse
Absolutely.
Into what you do?
We've been around for 41 years, and we specialize in counseling services, mediation services, facilitated access services, and we offer those services to children as young as four for the counseling, expressive art therapies, and that kind of thing. We help people navigate through the court process as well. We're not lawyers, but we offer legal support and information as well. And we serve about 900 to 950 people a year come through our doors and around for a long time, and always seeking out, identifying, and then addressing needs within the community.
Now, you've read this play, Every Brilliant Thing.
Many times.
Oh, many times. Okay.
I actually use this play when I'm working with my clients. So when I was asked to do this, I couldn't believe the serendipity of it.
Yeah.
I thought, ooh, I know this one. and so I think the play was written in 2015. And I was working with a family, and the children were really, really at risk. Mother had a severe mental health issue, and there wasn't really any literature. There wasn't really any way to explain to these children what was happening to their parent. And I thought, there's got to be something out there. And I ended up getting in touch with a British psychiatrist who said to me, have you read Every Brilliant Thing? And I said, no, I've never heard of it. And he said he'd been to several performances when it was traveling through the UK. And he told me about it, and I got a copy of the script. And when Estelle said it's powerful and it's really, really an important play to see, that is so true. And I use it with, probably it's my go-to piece when I'm working with children who have a parent with mental health issues, who've lost a parent because of mental health issues, and a number of the children who come through our agency have parents with addiction issues, other mental health issues as well. Some of them haven't lost their parent physically, but they've lost their parent emotionally and psychologically. So when I read the play, I couldn't believe that it was something that I would so beautifully fit what I do and how I could weave that into the therapeutic sessions. So I'm very familiar with it.
That's fascinating. And so how does it, and I want to hear what you think more about the play, but I'm curious, how does it help? Does it help children comprehend what their parents are dealing with?
Well, there's that aspect to it, and also it's so real. The comments that the narrator makes when they're in the role of, you know, when they're playing the role of the child, the perception, the feelings, these are all things that I hear in my practice. So it's very, very real. The humor is real. There are times when the subject obviously is very, very heavy and very important. And then there's what was going on in the play and how it was actually mirrored in my private practice. And I thought, boy, these people really knew what they were talking about when they crafted this play.
And so what are some of the questions it raises, the play about death and loss and suicide and grief?
I think a big part of it is how it's addressed, how it's perceived. In the families with whom I work, sometimes there isn't a word for mental health. When I work with some immigrant and refugee families, there isn't a word in their culture for mental health. The only word there is a crazy. It's just, that's what it means. So depending on who I'm working with and where they come from and what their beliefs are, there's how the issue is dealt with by the individual, by the immediate family, perhaps perceived or even discussed or even aware of. in terms of the extended family, and then how that actually pervades the school culture, the peer culture, and how it affects the children from a developmental perspective as well. So a lot of it is how is it addressed? Is it even known? And a lot of families, no one else knows that there's an issue going on.
And what about the idea of coping? As a psychotherapist, how do you think the play approaches the idea of coping?
Well, I think it's very real. For the child is just trying to understand what's going on. It's not uncommon for children to take on a caregiving or a caretaker role and really think, you know, if I could just do this better, if I could just create this list, mom will be okay. Or my dad will be okay. And so developmentally, they're very often placed in a position where they don't have the skills, they don't have the life experience, they don't have that perspective, if you will. And a lot of them take on very, very adult and very mature roles at a time in their life where developmentally they're just very, very young. And it's not a role they should be taking on anyway.
Of course, any given story can only do and cover so much. Are there other approaches that aren't in the play that you advocate as a psychotherapist?
Well, being able to identify that either you or someone else you love or you know is in trouble is a big part of it. And then being able to have that initial conversation where you say, you know, you seem to be not yourself, you seem to be kind of sad. There are people who exhibit those symptoms, and there are people, quite frankly, who mask them very, very well, and you would not know. I've had friends, and I'd say I'm pretty experienced in this, but I've had friends who've committed suicide, and no one knew, and it was a complete shock. And I've probably one of the people in the group of friends thinking, you know, if anyone should have seen this, it should have been me, because I work with it every day, and I've been working with it every day for many, many years. So there are people who don't exhibit what we refer to as the classic symptoms of depression or another kind of mental illness. And then there are people who are labeled, and they're labeled inaccurately. They're misdiagnosed. They're not getting the treatment they need. They're not being compliant with the treatment they're being given. And at the end of the day, and I love this in the play, oh, I don't want to give it away. Oh, I can't give it away. I can't give it away. No, I can't do that.
We'll
I promised myself
that
I wouldn't
weeks.
Do that.
Yeah.
I promised myself. But there's so much in this. It's just so rich. You're going to love it. It's brilliant.
One of the things that I suspect will resonate with a lot of people, and you've just touched on it earlier, is the idea of absence. Someone who's there physically, but they're not really there. And I understand in this play, Mum specifically exemplifies that. Is that right?
Yeah, Mum is the one who suffers from the illness. And we see that a lot when we work with the children, is that they'll say, you know, Mum's there or Dad's there, but they don't really seem to kind of be listening. They don't seem to participate. They're in the house, but they don't come to a play. They don't go and talk to my teachers. So there's a physical presence of the parent, which can be really confusing for children, because if you're physically there, you should be there in all other aspects. So when they're not, the children tend to think that sometimes a lot of them will think it's their fault. And if only they could be a different child, they could have said it a different way, they could have done something the parent asked them to do, maybe that parent would be better. There's a wonderful line in the play, and I don't want to give it away either. It's really hard. Self-restraint is tough for me. But it's one of those questions where, you know, if only I could have done more, and maybe if I create this list, this will really, really help. And I love that simplicity. If we could just think of things that give us joy. And it's so easy to get bogged down in the things that are sad and things we can't control and things we can't do anything about, and then to come up with such a lovely, simple thing, but it represents so much more than simplicity. It represents the complexity of what we go through and what our children go through. And at the end of the day, if we haven't had a time in our lives where we've been really down, I don't think we've lived. But when children are going through this and they're watching a parent suffer, they just really, really want to be able to make it better. But they don't know how. And so we see the anxiety, we see the confusion in children, we see a sense of isolation and alienation because they want to connect with the parent who's ill, but the parent who's ill simply can't connect. It's not because they don't want to. It's because they simply can't do it. And that can be very odd for a child and very very sad for a child as well.
Are there resources in the community that you could recommend? And I know there are, but in terms of finding help, perhaps, if some of these issues resonate with people during the play or just in their everyday lives?
Absolutely. What we've done for the purposes of the play and also for internal purposes at the agencies, we've created a community resource guide. And we're going to make that available to people after the show. And if you know of somebody who is struggling or you yourself may be struggling, please take it. It addresses everything from mental health issues to housing to seniors issues, the numbers for child and youth mental health, adult mental health. And it's just a terrific, literally recently published, as of I think yesterday, up-to-date resource guide for this for the Greater Victoria as well, and it should be of great help. And what it does in that is a lot of people don't really know what it is that they're going through, or they don't really know what a friend may be going through, but this will give you a chance to flip through it and say, these are some of the things that I think could be issues, and then this is a very, very resource-rich city. So if there are any issues, you have any concerns, you can always call us at Family Services of Greater Victoria. If we can't provide the service, we're very, very well aware of the other services in the community, and we make a lot of referrals out to other agencies as well. We also partner with other people, and we're more than happy to help you out. So if you're really, really stuck, there's also a crisis line you can call, and all of that information will be on the resource guide that we'll make available at the end of the performances.
I want to ask you finally, Jane, about who you take to the theater as your date, so to speak. You know, it's often a question, who are we going to go with? And I wonder about your thought on family or friends going, either people who are living with depression or mental illness with someone they love who may or may not fully comprehend it, or the other way around, people wanting to get an understanding and maybe inviting someone who's been living with depression.
Well, I'm coming four times. So opening night, my date is a colleague of mine who is just finishing up her master's in child and youth care. And she has also got a background like me in theater. So I said to her, because of the interactive nature of the performance, I thought she'd be a perfect person to bring. And then I'm thinking, in all honesty, about the other people to bring, because it's tricky, quite frankly. And so I'd love more colleagues to come, because I'd like them to actually be more aware of the script and actually, like myself, be able to integrate the learnings from the script into the work that we actually do with our clients and their families. But it's a little bit of a tricky one. Mm-hmm. And I think when I first met with the with Estelle and Dawn and the crew, probably 2 or 3 weeks ago now, we talked about that. And we thought, you know, what if people are triggered? What if they're actually triggered when they're actually coming to the performance? You know, what do we do for that? Which is why actually Estelle had the idea for the resource guide, which was really, really good idea. And then it's tricky, but at the end of the day, there's so much humor in it, and I think that's what Estelle spoke to so beautifully. This is very human, it's very real, and I think most of us, at least if we don't know somebody who's committed suicide, we likely know someone or have heard of someone who's experienced suicidal ideation, and certainly sadness and depression. And the humor in it makes it very, very human, and it makes it very, very real.
Jane, thank you for this. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Jane Taylor is the Executive Director of Family Services of Greater Victoria. And our final guest is Ron Penner. Ron registered as a psychologist in 1983 and attained his honors BA at the University of Kansas and MA and PhD through the University of Victoria. Dr. Penner is currently a contractor with an integrated health team at CFB Esquimalt at the Canadian Forces Base, where he carries out diagnostic assessment, treatment, and counseling. And prior to that, he worked in private practice, hospital, and forensic settings. Central areas of focus have included anxiety, mood, and trauma-related disorders, neuropsychological testing, learning and attention issues, and adaptation to acquired disabilities. And he's here to talk to us about his current work and some of the themes in the play as well. Please welcome Dr. Ron Penner. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Hello, everyone.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a bit about your journey as a psychologist and the work you do right now?
Yes. Shortly after completing my doctorate, I worked for a few years as a research officer with mental health programs and long-term care. and soon found myself in a clinical setting where I took a job at Nanaimo Regional General Hospital, where I had excellent diverse experience, both doing inpatient and outpatient work for nearly a 10-year period. And I gradually merged into private practice, first part-time and then full-time for quite a few years. And again, there was diverse experience in that as well. A lot of medical legal assessments, some in the forensic area, a lot of assessments and treatment in many different areas, including mood and anxiety disorders, trauma, learning disabilities, attention deficit, and so on. So I was feel very fortunate I've been able to attain a broad range of experience with some subspecialties as well. And then just over 10 years ago, I took a position with the Canadian Forces based starting in Edmonton. And after half a year there, when I found out the same position became available here in Esquimalt, I moved back here. So I've been there for about 10 or 11 years working in a military setting as a contractor.
And what's that been like, and what are some of the issues that you might deal with in a military setting?
Well, actually, it's the full range of issues in any context. It's really not that different, except, of course, you get a lot of issues pertaining to trauma directly related to service, you know, like being in theater, in combat situations, or being in major disasters, as a diver or on ship, mm-hmm. and so mm-hmm. forth. So there's a wide range of specific military-related trauma, but outside of that, the overall range of issues is really not different than in any setting that I've worked in.
A lot of these are just universal issues.
Absolutely.
And so what are some of the themes discussed in the play that might resonate with you and your practice and experience?
Well, certainly the main theme is depression, and that's among, if not the most common, reason people either seek treatment or referred for treatment. Mm-hmm. And of course, along with depression, often co-occurring are anxiety and trauma-related issues as well. But certainly depression cuts across any of the contexts, and it's a very common issue.
As a psychologist, you've worked both, as you mentioned, in the clinical and non-clinical settings. What do you think about this play? How do you think Every Brilliant Thing might create space for both dialogue and hopefully healing?
Well, in a number of ways. One thing that comes to mind is that often I've asked people who are improving in treatment what they attribute it to. And you get a wide range of answers, like it might be the medication. If they're on medication, it might be a particular situational circumstances resolving or at least decreasing in severity. It might be particular things they're learning in a treatment approach. But the most common answer you get and what they attribute it to is simply having somebody to talk to. But not anyone. Like sometimes it can be very helpful talking to a good friend or family member, but more often than not, they approach it through a well-meaning approach, giving advice, oh, things will be better. What they really need is space from somebody who is really interested in listening, that they feel comfortable in opening up, and the person needs to be, you know, very non-judgmental, of course, so they have the space to explore everything. And that kind of relationship is probably the most common factor that people attribute improvement. And then when I thought of that, I was actually kind of sad thinking about the play, which I read for the first time earlier this week, mm-hmm. because I thought all three of the characters that mentioned in the play, only one of them present, from what I gathered from the script, yeah. all three of those could have had their lives transformed had they simply talked to somebody, whether it's a professional or non-professional, that who would have been very non-judgmental and caring, compassionate. They could just explore and open up. A lot of people have a good support system, but sadly choose not to use it, you know, because they don't want to burden other people. Mm-hmm. So it really brought that factor to mind, that those three characters, had they just talked to somebody openly, think of how their lives might have changed and how that might have impacted the others close to them.
And so what are some of the things that prevent people from seeking that out? I mean, is it a question of stigma, which we hear a lot about these days, or, mm-hmm. or is there something just innate in some people that they don't want to bother others, or they're too shy or reticent to share?
I think it could be both, but certainly there's issues of stigma. And they're, whether perceived or real, sometimes there really is stigma, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's fairly accurate. They're perceiving it accurately, and they're right not to open up. But more often than not, it's perceived stigma that's not really there. Some of it comes from maybe culture, whether it's a family culture that they were brought up in, maybe it's a larger culture. So there's a reluctance, but that's improving. I think it's decreasing, and I see it decreasing certainly in the military setting and in the civilian setting as well. It's always going to be there, but it's definitely decreasing. Some of it is just somebody's character where they naturally prefer to be private mm-hmm. and internalize and mm-hmm. so forth. But in terms of healing, on a positive note, the thing that really struck me with the list is it fits so nicely with the accumulating research on gratitude over the last couple of decades. There's very strong, well-designed experimental research that shows many benefits from gratitude practices, the list being a good example yeah. of one of them. Can you
explain that in case anyone's not familiar? What is a gratitude practice and how, for instance?
Well, one example, look at a lot of the studies, it's very simple. They might have somebody write, say, three things every day that they're grateful for. You know, it's a wide range. It could be anything. And they do this each day. And during the experimental period, they're doing something. They're making, they're listing three or whatever the number is, things of gratitude each day. And then they stop doing it, or you compare different groups. And so they've, you know, had many different ways of operationalizing that. But that would be a common way, just to have a short list that you do each day.
And there's a lot of cynicism in the world, Ron, you know, especially in the line of work I'm in. But people might see something like that and say, oh, well, it's just words, or it's just filling mm-hmm. out a list. How have you observed it, that sort of thing help people? How can it be genuinely helpful, and what's going on there when it is?
Well, I think it relates to what's been called the negativity bias in the brain. Rick Hansen, who wrote Buddha's Brain and another book called Just One Thing, talks a lot about that, is that for biological evolutionary reasons, the brain is, for most people, biased to focus on negative aspects of threat for survival. And there's very, you know, many reasons why that's the case. Usually we have to go out of our way to do something to make it a little more balanced. So we have to go out of our way to build in positivity practices to counteract that, right? So you know, so very simple ways of doing it, but the research does show it has powerful effects. But even people who do the practices and know it works have a hard time keeping it up regularly. Mm.
Yeah. And is that because of that inherent negativity bias?
I think so, yes.
Keeps pushing downwards, yes. as it were. Mm-hmm. As a psychologist and one who's worked in so many various settings, if you want to diagnose the character of dad and mom, what would your analysis be?
Okay, well, I found that both very frustrating and refreshing at the same time. It was frustrating because as a psychologist who does so much diagnostic work, my mind instantly gravitates towards thinking of the possible diagnoses, and it's very easy to speculate, but there's not enough information in the play for anybody to really give a firm diagnosis. Mm. But that's also refreshing at the same time, because that means it's more relatable to the general population, as it should be. Right. Yes. So if you could say, well, each of these three characters had very clearly this right. mental illness, so to speak, well, then it doesn't seem as universal, right? But really, the issues are, I think they're meant to be universal. They apply to all of us. And the fact that there's not enough information is actually a good thing. But as an example of where I would speculate, well, for the mother, it would be pretty easy to say, well, yes, she was depressed, but did she meet the criteria for what we now call major depressive disorder, right. But was that one big long episode, or was it a series of several discrete recurrent episodes where she was okay in between, or did she have some form of a bipolar disorder, or was mother depressed because she was living with this husband who was very detached and distant and avoidant and couldn't connect to? Maybe she was depressed because of that and she was different before. We have no way of knowing, mm-hmm. So you can go on and on speculating. The child, when she became an adult, in the script it was a boy, so I was taken aback when I saw in the play it's a girl. But either way, as an adult, obviously struggled with depression, at least at some mild level, even whether it was of clinical severity or not, we don't know, but there was some depressed mood there. And then the father, of course, was withdrawn and avoidant and so on and struggled with depression, but we have no way of knowing whether it was clinical severity or whether they took medication or anything like that. But I think it's good that that was left open.
Yeah. I want to ask you finally about humor. I wonder, A, how you reacted to it in reading this play, and B, if you think there is a role, perhaps there is, in a clinical setting or in psychology in general. I plead total ignorance. Does humor come into therapy ever? Is it helpful? What are your thoughts on humor and depression?
For me personally, I don't think I'd be able to do my job without humor. To me, it's a very important aspect of what of the whole thing. It's important for me personally in doing the work, and I think it's important for the clients I work with to be able to look at issues from multiple perspectives. Yeah, to me, it's absolutely not only is it possible, to me, it's essential. It's an essential part of therapeutic work.
Well, it's great to have you with us as well today. Thank you very much for joining us at Before Play.
Thank you.
Dr. Ron Penner, who is a psychologist and currently a contractor with the Integrated Health Team at CFB Esquimalt. That is our Before Play for today. Thank you, everyone, for coming and for listening via Facebook Live and watching via Facebook Live. And remember, the box office is open on your way out.